takes its toll. Your life is one big crazy ride, but nothing really takes me back like Thomas Road, where dreams begin. Thomas Road made me who I am. All those memories keep calling me back home. Thomas Road. Yeah.
Welcome to the Life 2.0 podcast. I'm John St. Augustine. I am glad that you're taking time out of your schedule to spend it with me today and my very special guest, one of the most enduring and powerful voices in country music for the last 25 years, John Barry. Matter of fact, that song you heard coming in, his unmistakable tenor, is called Thomas Road. It's the title track from his latest CD. And this is one of those, this wasn't on my schedule kind of deals. But sometimes the universe has other plans. And when synchronicity and technology line up, next thing you know, I'm sitting in a bus in the Woodfield Mall parking lot. I still can't believe this happened. With John Barry and Bentley the dog and Robin and the band and Brian. And pretty soon, next thing you know, it's just Bentley and I and Brian and John. And for the next hour or so, we had quite a conversation around his life and his music and his journey. And maybe more than anything else, his faith. And so what you're going to hear today is a total impromptu conversation, zero notes. I mean, I don't really use notes anyway. This was like in the negative with notes. This was just off the top of our head, like a couple guys sitting around John on a bus in a parking lot at Woodfield Mall. So, of course, you know, during his star-making decade, John placed 20 singles on the country charts, six which went to the top five. With Your Love Amazes Me scoring a number one on the Billboard and Radio and Records country chart, as well as Standing on the Edge of Goodbye, which is a phenomenal song. She's Taken a Shine, my personal favorite, which earned the number one slot in Radio and Records. He's earned multiple gold and platinum records over the years. He was nominated for the ACM Top New Male Vocalist back in 1994. He won a Grammy Award in 1996 for his participation in Amazing Grace, A Country Salute to Gospel, Volume 1, and was nominated for another Grammy in 1995. For that smash hit, Your Love Amazes Me, and then nominated for the CMA Horizon Award and Top Male Vocalist Award in 1995. 1997, of course, he was nominated for the Vocal Event of the Year for Long-Haired Country Boy with Charlie Daniels and Hal Ketchum. And in 2013, John was nominated for the Mainstream Country Music Artist by the ICM Awards. And thanks to the miracles of modern technology, he even sang a duet with the late, great Patsy Cline. How cool is that? But that's just the headline stuff. What you're going to hear today is the lifeline stuff. And it's an ongoing conversation I've had with John over many years of our friendship on and off the air. And this, to me, was, again, full disclosure here. I just sent Brian, his manager, a note and said, I've done thousands of shows. I've done thousands of interviews. There's something about what's going on with this one. Maybe it's the way it lined up. I don't know. But when I'm editing a show and the hair on my arm stands up, that means it's going to be really good for you as well. And it's like you're listening over our shoulder into one of the most interesting conversations I've had in a very, very long time. Inspiration, as I've always said, can lead to transformation, but you got to kind of pay attention in between the notes. You're not going to believe where I'm coming to you from in this Life 2.0 podcast. So let me just set this up real quick so I don't have to do it later, because otherwise I'll lose it and I'll forget it. I'm working all day on podcast stuff, and I got subscribers and I got sponsors and I got all this technical stuff going on, and it's just freaking me out. I'm just bugged out on this stuff. And I happen to jump over to Facebook just to take a little break, see what's going on in the internet landfill. And what do I see but Brian Smith, the vaunted roadman, the guy who is the host with the most, Mr. Talent himself from Nashville, Tennessee. And I see that he is in a laundromat. That's right, in Elk Grove Village, Illinois, which is literally a 27-minute drive from my house. And I thought, what in the wide, wide world of sports is going on? How in the world is Brian Smith in a laundromat? Then I start to see the pictures roll through, and the guys he's with, I'm like, I've seen those guys before. They're on stage backing up John Barry. What's John Barry doing at a laundromat in Elk Grove Village, Illinois? It's a long way from Nashville, Tennessee. So now we're doing this show literally from the bus at the Woodfield Mall just outside of Chicago. Nobody else got a podcast like this. I'm sitting here with John Barry.
Hey.
Hey. Who's half awake. Brian Smith's over here kind of giggling in the corner. And Bentley's keeping a watch because everybody else is shopping at the mall. What are you doing up here?
Well, we're on our way to Minnesota. We're going up to Albert Lee for a show. Well, we actually played in Kalamazoo last night at the State Theater and pulled out of there. And then we spent a little time this morning at a truck stop getting some the trailer light wiring redone. Because the lights kept flashing on and off and on and off and off.
And then on.
And on and off. And then that was it. And so we had to get that rewired this morning, and it's always something with the bus, you know.
Sure.
And then we decided we would make the most of our trying to go ahead and knock out, get some laundry done, and then find a place where we could go grab something to eat, maybe go see a movie, and just, you know, let our driver get some sleep.
Right.
And so here we are.
The rich life of a country music superstar.
Rocking
a
it.
Legend.
The legend in my spare time.
So when I texted Brian, I'm like, because I'm thinking you had a day, maybe you went back home and, you know, you took a day and catch up later. And he's like, no, he's on the bus getting his dirty laundry together.
Yeah.
I think that's one
sheets off my bunk.
That's it. I think that's one of the things. And this is kind of really cool, actually. The last couple times we talked, the first time we met, and I don't remember all the circumstances that were around it, but you guys, we had, I don't know if it was the same bus, pulled up in front of Harpo. Where the Oprah Winfrey, is this the same bus?
No, that was our big white 45-foot Silver
Eagle.
Yeah, we bought that bus brand new in 1996.
Really?
And it had a custom pearl white finish, GMC pearl white finish paint on it, and a polished stainless steel bottom.
Your eyes are glazing over a little bit.
And you know what's really crazy?
What's that?
I got an email the other day that bus was for sale.
Come on.
Yeah.
Wow.
But my little bus here actually is very similar in look from the outside.
Mm-hmm.
But this one is paid for, so I'm not doing
exactly. I don't remember what the circumstances were. I really don't.
My kids were on the bus.
Yeah.
Robin was on the bus.
We sent you some of the guys into the showers at the Oprah show.
Yeah, yeah.
Robin was, that's
right. Yeah, we got some of the folks off the bus so they could get cleaned up that day and make use of the stop. And, I remember it vividly.
Came over, the radio where I was at was across the street.
Yeah.
And we parked the bus on Carpenter Street, and all these people were waiting in line to go to the Oprah show.
Right. I remember that.
And you got out, and they're like, who's that guy?
Who is that? Who is that? John Barry. John Barry. Nope, didn't ring a bell.
Yeah, and then they kind of went about their business. But somewhere I have to find it, get it to you. I still have that original audio. We had a long conversation, and I think we were doing it for a couple specials, and I don't remember where it all kind of got lost in translation. But anyway, this is a lot cooler. We had a big-time million-dollar studio in the beginning, and now we're on your bus in a parking lot with the dog and Brian.
Yeah, if your listeners will turn the volume up loud, they can hear the generator in the background going.
Oh, boy. What I wanted to talk about, even though this is very impromptu and I got nothing, we've had conversations on and off for years, is this part of your life, which very few people see. I mean, how many times in the last year or so you've been at the Opry, you get standing ovations, and you did Old Holy Night recently and knocked it out of the park, and here you are in Woodfield. How do you adapt to, or how have you adapted to this part of the career?
Well, this is the real part of it. This is the real stuff. This is the riding up and down the road and wondering if you're going to lose your trailer and if the lights are going to work and, you know, and all the you know, just the trying to be sure you got 10 people on the bus and everybody's cool, you know, because you got a lot of personalities out here and big personalities. And so you want to make sure everybody's that's a good event for everybody out here, you know, so. So it's a lot to do, and my wife is the cruise director, Robin. She's the entertainment coordinator.
This is your 22nd Christmas tour?
Yeah.
22 years you've been doing. So it kind of morphed into something. You've become like the Bing Crosby of country music on the road in Christmas time. But you don't go out much the rest of the year. This is kind of your thing.
Well, we do some. Yeah, I mean, and we will. Call me. 1-800-GET-JOHN.
Yeah, right.
and we'll go out. We go out and play. We do a lot of solo, just me and my guitar stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We do what we call our trio show, which is me, Mike, and Robin, my bass player, Michael, you met a few months
ago.
Yeah,
I did, yeah.
And we do a lot of trios. And then it's what we call the Eddie's Attic Band. Eddie's Attic is a place in Decatur, Georgia that we go play. That's absolutely really a spectacular room. And it's not real big. And so we sort of squeeze in there with a small drum kit, bass, guitar player who plays a little electric, mainly acoustic, but a little electric. And then a utility player who plays a little fiddle, a little acoustic, little keyboards, just what. And me and Robin. And we go do a lot of that configuration too. So and then Christmas, you know, we probably do another 50 or 60 shows during the year, and then we do about 20 to 25 at Christmas.
How did the Christmas tour come about in the beginning?
Well, it all started is Christmas after Robin and I got married. Fred Rowell was the pastor at Green Acres Baptist Church, because Green Acres is the place to be. And that's where Robin grew up, in the neighborhood Green Acres subdivision in Athens, Georgia. She grew up there, grew up going to church there, and we got married there. Fred married us, and much to the dismay of the church, a lot of them were a little shocked that the young man who plays at the bars stole one of our young girls.
Oh, boy.
But Fred saw something in me that I don't know if everybody else saw, and he asked me if I would come do a Christmas thing, a little performance.
Was it kind of a PR move on his part to have people kind of accept you
better? He just loved me and Robin, and just he loved what I did, and he'd come hear me play some. And
so this is 22 years. So you already
had. This was a long time. No, this was back in 1988.
Wow. This is 30 years before all the big stuff hit.
Oh, yeah, before I had a record deal.
Wow.
And
this is selling CDs out of the trunk time?
Yeah.
Wow.
And so we set up, we went and did it with me and Robin and her sister-in-law, Tracy. Tracy was married to Robin's brother, and she has a lovely voice. And our church pianist, Betsy Williams. And we did this little 45-minute Christmas program, and I did Old Holy Night, and it was just...
Because you can do that.
Just, it just happened.
Yes.
It all turned into something.
Wow.
And then we did it for a couple more years. And then we started adding my band that played the clubs with me in Athens. And one of the guys in our band was Andy Carlson, who is an extraordinary fiddle player, but was also the first chair violinist at the University Symphony.
Oh, wow.
And now he's a professor up in Indiana. And I'm trying to remember the name of the school he's at, but it won't come to me right now. I'll think of it. And he's a professor of, you know, violin and string instruments.
Sure.
And so he got some of his friends from the University Symphony to come play with us. So we had the string section.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, Rednecks on Parade with a string section. And you know, we had like four violins. Four violins, three violas, a cello, I can't remember.
Partridge in a Pear Tree, and you were good. Yeah.
And it was fabulous.
Yeah,
it was just beautiful.
Wow.
And so we did that for a few more years, and it grew every year. It was and it turned into this thing there in Athens. And then after I got my record deal, we continued to do it and continued to grow. And then we, you know, we did three nights at Green Acres after things were really starting to kick up. And it really, it ended up, it got a little out of hand. And we ended up moving the show to the Classic Center in Athens, Georgia. We went and did it there. And it was a 2,200-seat theater. It was huge. And we... I recorded. I was actually scheduled to record to go in and record two songs. Chuck Howard and I had been talking about the Christmas show we did at home, and he said we should go in and record a couple of songs and see where we're at.
Sure.
And it was scheduled for June of '94 during Fanfare. And so everything was all scheduled up, you know. And I started not feeling well in '94.
Yeah.
May 10th of '94, the day Your Love Amazes Me was a number one record on R&R. I had brain surgery that morning.
Yeah.
Don't recommend it unless you need it. and a week or so later, we're like, oh my gosh, Chuck. He said, oh, we got that thing scheduled. We should cancel that. And I said, oh no. I need to get out of the house.
Yeah.
Come on, let me do this. And so we went in and recorded with the band, the basic band, you know, O Holy Night and O Come Emmanuel. And it was lovely. It was just lovely. And it was actually kind of surreal because I was still, I'd had brain surgery 28 days before.
Right. That's pushing it.
Yeah. I was still on some pretty heavy duty meds.
So everything sounded good.
Yeah. It was awesome. And it was real emotional to be in there. It's real emotional.
Yeah, how so?
Well, there's a video somewhere of a couple of days before, I think the day before I left to go to the hospital in Atlanta for the brain surgery. Robin took the kids and went to her mom's, get all the stuff set up so she and I could go down, and because she just had a baby a couple weeks before, and we had a little girl, Taylor Marie, and so she took them to Mama's to get them all situated, and then come home, get us ready to pack to leave to go the next morning to Atlanta. And while she was gone, I went and sat in my office and videotaped me singing all my favorite songs because I knew
really
they were going to find more than we bargained for.
You knew this.
I knew it.
Yeah.
And so I walked around my farm, this piece of land that I loved. I bought it when it was just woods and old peach orchard. And I stripped off the old peach orchard with an old chainsaw and an axe. And we built a little cottage house out there, and we built a barn and all this stuff. And I walked around and I told myself the story in case I couldn't remember it again.
Wow.
And I've never seen the tape. I've never
really
read it. Yeah.
Why?
I'm afraid to. I'm just kind of, I don't know.
Something.
I don't know. It's just you, because I sat in my office and I sang all my favorite songs. Songs I'd loved, you know, Please Come to Boston and Sweet Baby Jane.
Just in case.
All these songs, in case I didn't get to sing them again.
Wow.
So a month later, a month later, to be in a studio recording Oh Holy Night.
Which is arguably probably, listen, everybody's got their favorites that knock it out, there's no question, but you'd be hard-pressed to not put your version up against the versions.
Yeah.
And you know this, right? I mean, this is what people wait for. He's like, yeah, whatever. No, people wait for this.
Well, it's one of those magical moments that could not be recreated. Because there we are in the studio recording this, and you know, after we did the basic tracking, which I don't remember a lot of it. I don't remember 2 years.
Right. Yeah.
And but Connie Ellisor came in and played violin, and John Ketchings played cello. And Connie's violin kept going out of tune. World class violinist. And I'm like, what in the world?
Yeah. What's that all about?
So Chuck Howard, he says over the headphones, Connie, what's up with your instrument? And she says, well, I'm sitting here listening to John sing this song, knowing a month ago we're praying that he would survive it, much less sing it. And the tears are running down my face, and they're landing on my violin and making it go out of tune.
Wow.
So there is no doubt that something we captured something that day that is not creatable.
Right, right.
You just don't create stuff like that.
Right.
It's just not possible.
Right.
And so it's one of those recordings that are just... And it's one of those records. To me, the art of recording is whatever emotion it is you're trying to create around a song.
Mm-hmm.
How can you capture that? And somebody spin a CD in Chicago 15 years later and still feel it.
Right.
How much fun was Garth having when they cut Friends in Low Paid
Places? Right, right.
What was the emotion in the room when Alan Jackson cut the song about the Twin Towers?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, now all these years later,
yeah.
I put that on and I can feel it.
There's something about two things, especially when it comes to radio airplay, and I've said this, I go out and do a lot of consulting and speaking things in the media and stuff, and I say, you know, the average person who's 60 years old knows the words to 3,500 songs they never intended to learn because of repetition.
Yeah.
And that's one thing. That's why, you know, we could all, you can say, I drove my Chevy to the levee and,
yeah,
right? Everybody knows it because of repetition. But that's just the repetition part, the ripple effect from the energy of the emotional connections to those words, where you were at, what you were doing,
yeah,
how it hit you, to capture that, that's a whole different thing. And so I'm driving out here, catching up to you guys, and Norman Greenbaum's on the radio, going up to the spirit in the sky. And I went all the way back to 1970. I don't
all
care what
sudden.
Year. Right? But that's what music does. And I think that's exactly what you're talking about,
yeah,
especially with O Holy Night.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine how many people that song takes them back to growing up,
mm-hmm,
and going to church service at Christmas time.
Absolutely.
And they're hearing, you know, they're hearing their grandma sing that song, yeah, again.
You know what it is for, yeah, me? Eighth grade, Belding School in Chicago, 30 miles from here. A kid named Jim Burnett, who I've never seen since, a couple years older than me. They come down and they start the Christmas concert. They put the red and green and yellow lights on that flip up on the stage.
Yeah.
And Jimmy Burnett, there's a nativity scene, and I'm up in the back balcony with my folks. And Jim Burnett gets on his knees and sings O Holy Night a cappella. Yeah, and, well, you know, his voice hadn't changed yet. So it was so high. And it went through me. And as a kid I went to school with, I've never seen him since. So that song carries such weight with me. So I hear all the different versions of it.
Yeah.
And you're right. It becomes a bookmark for people.
Sure. If a song can take you somewhere, if a song can take you back on a trip,
mm-hmm,
especially a pleasant one.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, there's nothing. I mean, that's the deal right there, man.
And this is what's interesting to me. So here we're on this bus. You're headed to Albert Lea tomorrow. It's a long way from just knocking out a few Christmas concerts 22 years ago, John. This,
sure,
has become appointed listening and attendance for thousands of John Barry fans that know you're coming, put aside everything else, yeah, to sit there and listen. How do you feel like that almost a quarter of a century later?
It's crazy. It's crazy. And it's really been fun this year. Because I have consciously stood on stage and sang for them. I stand there and sing for each one of them. I stand there and sing, and I don't think about the lighting. Because I'm a production nut.
Yeah.
I don't think about the sound. I don't think about the bus anymore. I don't think about, does my dog need to be taken out for a walk? I think about singing for those people in those seats, and with the advice of Charlie Daniels, I don't look at the empty seats if,
mm-hmm,
there are some.
Mm-hmm.
And I do my best to sing those songs as, and this is, I guess, an odd word, I try to sing them as beautifully as I can.
Mm.
I try to sing them, just to sing them just the way I think they were intended, whether they were written and intended to be sung,
mm,
and just with every little thing I can, and just put it out there.
I think that shows up in Beautifully Broken. Brian sent me the early clip on that.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what to do with it. I think it's one of those times where, because of your history and because of your experience, everything you've been through, you can color that song.
Yeah.
Because of brain surgery and all the rest that's gone on.
Sure.
How did you feel when you first got the lyrics and all that went along with it?
I was astonished at the song. Now, I had the advantage of having seen the rough of the movie. And of course, the rough, if your listeners don't know what a rough is, there's no music at all. Edits are not very smooth. There are going to be some changes coming. It's just dialogue and film. It's very dry. And then I heard the song. And it was like, oh my gosh, You're kidding me. This is just awesome. And I was thrilled to get to sing it. Just thrilled.
Every tear, every doubt, every time you're down and out, when you're hurting, feeling shame, or you're numb in all your pain, when you think you've lost your way, or you're too far gone to pray, he's still waiting there to say, you're beautifully broken.
Even though you didn't write it, you were able to put yourself in it. Is that easy to do, not easy to do?
If it's the right song, it's easy to do. You know, if you can sing a song and make people believe you, well, that's the deal. You know, I hear songs I've recorded before, on earlier records, and I go, no, I don't believe me. I don't believe me. And people don't buy it.
Really?
Emotionally or financially.
Right. It doesn't connect.
It doesn't translate. It doesn't connect.
Yeah.
And that's the deal. It has to connect.
Heartland thing, is that coming back, not coming back?
We're hoping. We're actually talking with Chuck Howard. We'd like to see if Chuck would produce it. And, you know, we love the folks that helped us do video before and all that, but we were hoping to take it to another level.
So if you haven't caught that yet, it's an incredible series, Songs and Stories. And I'm watching. This is what's interesting to me. You know, I've been in the media, like, I mean, I've been in 25 years, and you see this stuff, and you watch people's trajectory, and then you watch them take a dip, and you go up and around. And I remember the first time I heard one of your songs, probably She's Taking a Shine. I was driving my truck, and I'm like, this guy's got a voice. Maybe something will happen for him. Yeah. And here we are all these years later, and I'm watching this, and when I was watching the Songs and Stories, I'm thinking, it's one thing to perform live. It's another thing to put all the production around to make it look like it's live. And I'm watching in Chicago Songs and Stories and going, well, they pulled it off. So I was engaged in the process. Even though I know you, I'm engaged in it, which is, I think, the magic in it. And so the people that are watching that in television, that's the next generation of a song from a CD to watching on a flat screen feeling like you're connected.
Right.
How was that process for you? And how was the, I mean, you're a TV star now, man.
Well, about that.
Listen, you're out in Chicago. You're a TV star.
Well, it really is. It's to be on the other side of the microphone, to be interviewing these folks. I do have to say that the second season, which was much better than the first, and which is it's a good thing.
Well, that's what it's for.
Yeah, you don't want it to be the same. You want to get better at it. You know. Right. And it's nerve-wracking to me. I don't know how you guys interview people and make it just be so conversational. And that's what I tried to do. I wanted things to be conversational, and I wanted to pull something out of them without talking too much.
Well, that's the whole idea.
The whole Larry King concept. Say just enough to spark them to run their mouth for a while.
Right, that's right.
And spill it.
You notice how many times I turn my mic off and put it down and just let you. That's the whole drill.
Yeah, because the listeners are wanting to. Yeah. They want to tune in and find out what you have to say to your guest, but they want to hear your guest.
One of the things that I learned, and even watching Larry King, and I think to bring it even to this conversation is, you know, Larry King used to say that he asked the questions you'd ask if you were in his seat.
Yeah.
I want to ask the ones you haven't thought of yet.
Yeah.
And that's where you take people. And even just a few minutes ago, and I know this is going to come through when people hear this, when you were talking about that property you had and clearing the land, I was with you there because of the way you were speaking. And so watching Songs and Stories and you doing your songs and bring your guests in and do those things, I think it's especially the times we live in, which are so volatile. You know, you can sneeze and everybody's offended about everything.
Sure.
It seems like, I don't know if this is on purpose or not, but you become this, I don't want to say Woody Guthrie because that's kind of going one way, but you've become this guy that's able to hold a platform without any boundaries. Is that by intent?
Well, no, it wasn't by intent. And I think the lack of boundaries comes because I've never been...
Put you in a file drawer.
Yeah.
Compartmentalized, yeah.
Yeah. And put into a specific category. It's like they didn't know where to put my CDs in the store.
Right.
You know,
but that's a good problem. Elvis, right? I mean,
sure. Was it rock and roll? Is it country? Is it
exactly?
Was it?
Exactly.
And but you know, the downside to that is in our culture that moves so fast,
sure.
in this vast wasteland,
mm-hmm.
It's difficult for people to put what I call the trifecta: the name, face, and song together.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very difficult thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can ask a lot of casual listeners to name an artist and see if they can grab that face and name three of their songs.
Yeah.
That's a tough deal. I mean, because people are, and especially now, are just. I mean, it used to be listeners. They love the albums. They knew the albums. They knew the musician. They love reading the credits. You know.
Yeah.
But now we're so inundated with information.
Too much. Yeah.
It's like I don't need any more information.
Do you feel like, you know, like last time I saw you was a couple of years ago in Michigan, and you were walking the dog and changed the oil in the bus before the concert. You remember that? And I pull up and I'm like, he's walking the dog, which is fine. But the bus is on one side of the building, and I'm watching you do this. On the other side of the building, all your fans are streaming, and I'm thinking, they have no idea. And maybe it's better they don't. But I'm thinking this is more like the real deal, every man, every person life that you lead. And this and the stage almost is like 10% of the 90%.
Yeah. I mean, I don't, I'm not quite sure if what I do, if I didn't do, I might be a lot more successful.
How so?
If I didn't do all the other stuff, you know, I might spend more time writing songs.
Mm-hmm.
I might write a book. Who knows?
Well, don't get me started on that.
If I didn't spend so much time.
If I get any more emails from you at 3 o'clock in the morning, like, what do you think of this? Well, it's a start, you know.
if I didn't spend so much time under the hitch, you know, being sure the wiring's right, you know.
Yeah.
And but it's just, you know, it's just who I am.
I know, but part of this to me is like, this is what, and putting it in the country music file's all about. You're living it. This isn't like you flew in on a Learjet, and then they walk you to the stage, and then you walk out, and you know, and then you just hop around and do stuff. It seems, I think, maybe that's what lends is the real connection that your fans have to you. They know, even they may not see this, they know viscerally that you're putting in the time, you know?
Well, you know, I did an interview with somebody yesterday or day, I can't remember, a couple of days ago, and they said, well, have we covered everything? Is there anything you want, your fans need to know about the show or anything? I said, well, I don't know if they need to know or not, but my hands hurt really bad from working on the bus to get there to sing for them.
That's a thing.
They're killing me.
Yeah. And yet you still go out and hammer that guitar.
Yeah. You know, I got split nails and
I just, and I'm sitting, I notice, I'm like, you know.
And stained fingers. I've been working all day trying to get the grease off.
But when you think those guys that you listened to growing up, you know, I could see a Merle Haggard, I don't know if he changed his own oil in his bus, but you could see a guy like that would be out doing his own work. You know, I think there's a big gap between what you're offering people and kind of what's being sold these days. And I'm not a country music aficionado by any means, but I think I just can't imagine you with straight leg pants and little tiny boots and we got the hat, but other than that, that's about it. Do you feel like you're kind of old school compared to what's out there now?
Well, considering I'm almost 60, I'm pretty old school.
Yeah.
I keep forgetting that. I keep thinking I'm just a youngster, and I'm not. And that's one of the things I've been, and when I'm standing on stage singing, I don't think this, and I don't, because I don't think I'm an arrogant person. I don't think I have an arrogance about me. My father drilled into me and my brother and my sister about humility and how much God valued humility.
Mm-hmm.
But lately I've been standing on stage and I tell myself, you're not a kid. You deserve to be standing here. Sing it like you mean it. And that's just something I really tried to do.
We're about the same age. I'll be 60 at the end of the month. There's not a day that goes by that I don't roll back to the things my dad said to me.
Yeah.
And he's been gone 15, 18 years now.
Yeah, my dad 25 years.
There you go. And you can still hear it, though, which is really interesting. And I have my dad's picture on my desk. And if I ever feel a little too much of myself, I look at him and I think about what he did. He was a banker and he hated his job. He wanted to be an architect, never got there. And that's where I make the same connection. I'm thinking, I remember when my dad found out I could earn a living talking on the radio. He couldn't believe it. Now, he loved all the guys here at WGN, but my son being one of those, what's that all about? And he wasn't alive when I made it to WGN after Harpo, actually, after Oprah Radio.
Yeah.
And the first day I walked out of the Tribune Tower and I knew that 3 million people had been listening to his kid talk, I just kind of fist pumped a little bit, you know, and you kind of do that. But it's amazing how much this stuff in some ways pushes us forward, and at other times it holds it back. We kind of deal with that later in life.
Well, you know, when we lived on our farm north of Athens, we lived in a little community, Pocatalico, Georgia.
Easy for you to say.
Yeah. And we we started, I had 5 acres when I first moved out there, and ended up buying 5 next to me and 4 next to me and 8 next to me and 45 across the street and 60 next to that.
Mm.
and just lovely place, and love that place. I have a hard time even thinking about it or going by there. Or just, but down the road, our road, when you cross the four-way stop, it's the name changed. It was Horace Reed Road, and Horace lived at the other end of the road. And he was born in the old, there's an old shack there, and that was his grandmother's house, and that's where he was born. And he was a full-on farmer. That's mm-hmm. all he did. He farmed.
Mm-hmm.
Honest to goodness, plowed fields, raised cows, raised chickens. And he would stop by anytime he'd see me out there working on my place, putting in some fence posts or whatever it might be. He'd mm-hmm. stop and want to hear about where I've been.
Wow.
But when he had to go, when he looked at his watch and he had to go, that typically meant that he had, I don't know, 75,000 chickens
mm.
that were more important than anything I had to say that he had to go tend to.
Mm.
How important am I?
Yeah, that keeps things in perspective, doesn't it?
The man's got chickens that are more important than me, you know?
Remember,
But I know there's a story. I know there's a song.
Well, I was just going to say, John.
The song in Horace is, I got a call. We were on the road somewhere, and I got a call, and I knew it was from that area where we were from the prefix on the number. And it was Horace Reed's son, who I had never met. And he said, I just wanted to let you know, my dad was plowing the field today, and it's obvious what happened is he got off his tractor. He shut his tractor off,
mm-hmm.
got off his tractor, laid down that fresh plowed field, and passed away.
Wow.
Lived his whole life on that street.
Mm.
Born in that little shack, lived off that land, provided for his family all his life, and plowed that field and laid down that field. And there's just a big old song.
I know how that's not written yet. I don't know.
And isn't what
comes
story?
And it comes gone. To mind is Neil Young with Old Man.
Yeah,
that's
Old Man.
That,
look at my. Life.
And I'm thinking he, remember the story where he bought that property.
Yeah.
And he had that guy living there, and the guy said, how can you afford this? He goes, well, I got lucky. And the guy's like, that's just the darndest thing I've ever heard, because no one could afford all that property. Bought it from a couple lawyers.
Yeah.
But there's a song in there, boy.
There is.
Went right back to where he came from.
Yeah.
Right in the ground.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you're going to finish this tour. How do you, for downtime, how do you, listen, I know you want to change the oil all the time, but you can't. How do you relax? What do you cut back with?
Well, if there's a beach somewhere, that's
you're good.
I'm all about going to, especially Carolinas, Carolina coast, mm-hmm. South Carolina, especially, and Georgia coast. There's mm-hmm. not a lot of Georgia coast, but we have St. Simon's Island is very special to us. Robin and I spent our honeymoon there. Our daughter got married at the King and Prince Hotel and Resort.
A lot of circles closing in your life, huh?
Yeah, and I love that place so much, and don't get to go enough, but
yeah.
I'd love to. Every time we get to go, we love going to the beach. And a few times we've gone down. Matter of fact, this summer we went to Dolphin Island, Alabama, which is spectacular. And the hurricane came in while we were there.
Oh, I remember getting updates. You guys were okay.
Yeah, that was a little scary. I mean, they moved us from the beachfront house to a house across the street and in towards the thicker part of the island.
Right,
I guess it's hard to say, but
right.
The island, it's like a fish head with a long tail, and the house we were on was at the end of the tail.
Wow.
And I mean,
they moved you into the fish head.
Yeah. So moved us up to the fish head, and but it was great. It was, and I just love it. There's something about the salt water that just heals my soul. Mm-hmm. So
there's a lot of songs still have to be sung here. It looks like, or written. Don't you feel like that?
Sure.
You got the beach stuff. You got your buddy down the road. Does it trip a trigger and you start making notes on napkins and stuff like that? How's that work?
I keep a little running list on my notepad of ideas and. Either a song title or just a song about that or whatever, this or that. And
is it a difficult process for you?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Songwriting is horribly painful to me. Not that it's emotionally painful. It's just I'm not good at it. I'm not I never developed the writer's way.
And what is that?
Where you write something every day.
Just
write something.
Yeah, yeah.
Just write anything.
Yeah.
I went to the grocery store and I saw a cat. You know?
Exactly.
Just write something.
Yeah.
There's that, you know, and you have to exercise the writing
it's a
part
muscle.
Of your brain.
Yeah.
Just like you have to exercise the singing muscles in your throat to get the notes out to come and be right. And I just never developed that discipline.
However, this, and I just, it's full disclosure because it's my show. 6 o'clock in the morning about a month ago, I get an email, and it's paragraphs. And I thought, what is he up to now? My first thought was, you're a word guy. You're a lyric guy. You're a music guy. How could this be not, and how could it be difficult for you?
Yeah.
And so as I was reading all your little bits and pieces, I started to get a better mosaic of why you do what you do, how you do what you do, why you need to continue to do what you do. And I find it fascinating that you haven't, I hope you've been doing more of it. Have you? I don't need to see it.
A little bit.
I'm just saying. A little bit?
No bit. Yeah.
I had to give you some work to do while you're on the road. You got nothing else to do. You just be sitting here. I told the first thing I.
As soon as I finish up.
And change the oil and wash the dog and everything else and make sure everybody else is getting along.
See, if I didn't have all that stuff to do, I could do
that. No. But it is a muscle. You got to find the sweet spot. There's some point during the day or night when you're done.
Well, it's that whole thing, that writing something.
Yes.
And because if you keep priming the pump, sooner or later that water's gonna start flowing.
Well, yeah, and there's a lot of things that have happened in my life and that I just haven't really wanted to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've faced a lot of difficult things.
Mm-hmm.
I know there are a lot of people who have faced a lot more difficult things. And I guess the only, the solace I can find in it is that it will at least let people who have faced difficult, because a lot of times people face things they think they're alone in the world in that. And I've never gone through a divorce, but I imagine when people do that, they think they're the
end of the world. Yeah.
It's the end of the world, and no one else has done that. It's not. I know you've been divorced, but not. It was not like ours.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not like what I've gone through.
Yeah, you know, pain is like compound interest of the worst kind.
Yeah,
and whoever. We don't get to qualify, even though we try to, our pain versus your pain.
Sure.
I didn't have brain surgery, but I gave my daughter a kidney.
Yeah.
So it was a different procedure with maybe similar lessons, just different way of coming about it. Coming from someone like you, especially to the people who connect with your music, it's even more, I don't want to say profound, but impactful, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we just blew that out of the water. Where'd that all come from? I'm with John Barry. We're sitting in a bus with Bentley and Brian, and we're at Woodfield Mall, and everybody's inside spending the kind of cash that you can only spend in Chicago. And last few minutes
we better get off the phone and go get my wife,
because somebody's phone's been going off. It's probably your credit card charges coming through. But the last couple of minutes, this is one of those things that just synchronicity falls together. I was doing other things, and you're doing other things, and here we are. I don't want to waste the opportunity. Biggest lesson you've ever learned, as we both near 60, what's the big aha for you?
Oh, gosh.
In less than 9 seconds. No, I'm kidding. when the clouds part every now and again, it's kind of the same way. What?
You know, it's funny. I have these moments of almost clarity.
Almost.
I have these moments.
This close.
This close, and all of a sudden it fleets away, and I'm like, why? Why does it do that? I almost figured out life, right? Yeah. And it just zipped away. And I don't know. I don't know if I ever have any really aha moment of like that.
I think that's the most important question we can ask ourselves.
What's that?
What's my big aha?
Yeah.
You've been on the planet for 60 years, and you've gone through a lot of stuff. I remember the first time I asked somebody that question, they were pissed because they didn't have an answer.
Yeah.
And I think you know, we take up space for a certain amount of time.
Yeah.
And we don't often fill that space back as much as we take from the space.
Right.
And I wonder if we're gonna, if we're kind of in this classroom together, I want to take something out and go, oh, here it is for me. It may not be for everybody else. And I think for me, mine has been, I answered the call. I have faltered but never wavered. And that's all I got. And that's all I need. Whatever the call is, when it comes, I answer it. It's not ever easy. I don't always, 90% of the time, don't understand it. I falter, but I don't waver. And I feel like that's kind of my blueprint. And what I've had these life-changing moments, and I've gone with them. And to ridicule and dismay and difficulty, but I'm still here. So yeah. Maybe that's something.
I don't know. I don't know. A good friend of mine, one of my best friends, works a lot with high school people. And he said, I thought I might want to tell you. He said, I don't know why I've never told you this before. He said, but you are the lesson that I give on perseverance. And he said, you are the lesson that I teach high schoolers about not giving up. And that was really a moment that someone would, even though he's a good friend, but still that he would recognize that he said, I have never known you to do anything other than what it is you do. Regardless of level of success. He was around when I, because, you know, I cut 6 albums before I ever got a record deal. I cut the first 4 albums on a 4-track recorder in the basement of my parents' house. 4 of the worst records you've ever heard in your life. And all songs with good intentions, but horrible songs. I mean, just, oh my gosh.
Horrible songs.
Oh, I had no idea.
John Barry's horrible hits.
Oh, no. Oh, man. And I was the worst singer ever. And I sang like I was in church, oversang every note, you know, and it was awful. But I just did what I knew I was supposed to do. And this friend of mine says, when I talk to these youngsters about what they're going to do with their lives and what their calling is, and when they decide this is what I'm going to do, that you don't back down. When you get run over by a car, don't say, well, I'm going to quit doing this because I got run over by a car. You know, when you lose a parent and you're young and you don't let it change what you're supposed to do.
And you know what that feels like.
Yeah. I lost my mom when I was, 1981, so I was 21 years old. And unexpectedly, you know, she had a cerebral aneurysm. And fortunate that I did not find her at home. It's not a sad story. It's the sweetest story ever that I did not find my mom. I came home from work early that day, didn't find her in the house. When my dad got home, I heard him call me, and I was downstairs in my little studio messing around. And I went rushing upstairs, and the reason I didn't find my mom is she was in the little half bath in my mom and dad's room. But I had gone in my mom and dad's room and just glanced. I didn't see a light, didn't think to open the door.
Sure.
And every day when my mom was home, after lunch, she'd go to that little half bath and read her Bible, and she'd reach over and turn off the light and have her prayer time and pray for me and my brother and sister and for Jim, her dad, you know, my dad, and all her friends and fellow believers.
Sacred place.
Her sacred place, her prayer closet. And sometime during that prayer time, that aneurysm burst and she was gone. And in my faith and my belief is the next thing she saw was the light of Almighty God. So that's just the coolest thing ever.
But this goes back to a time you didn't have that picture in your head until you came home one day and your mom was explaining to you, maybe you were 10 years old, yeah. 10 years earlier.
Yeah, I was about 9.5 years old.
It was interesting how that was put in place.
Yeah.
So you could be witness to that later.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think as you're speaking about the gentleman, you know, who lays down in the farm.
Yeah.
And your mom lays down there, and it's all, you know, you start to see life sometimes when you get close to that clarity of, you see the puzzle pieces just a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm watching you talk, and like everything else you've said in this little conversation, we get to kind of go there with you. Not a lot of people would consider that, losing their mom in that way, as the sweetest thing.
Yeah. Well, and the things that came from it.
Like what?
For a young man to see his father cling to God after losing his wife of 34 years. Mm. And become and not lose his mind and not lose himself. He had difficult times. He had hard times facing it, but it strengthened his faith in God and during difficult days. And for a young man to see that,
yeah,
it was
huge.
Really great. And it's, you know, because I'd be out and, you know, I might be in the living room and I'll see my dad pull up to the house and then keep going.
Really?
And I knew he just couldn't turn in.
Yeah.
And mom wasn't there.
Mm.
But then, you know, to have him come home and, you know,
push through that
and to open that Bible up and read and study and just find that comfort in that. And
a lot of these days, that's quite a while ago, your mom passed. Things have changed a little bit in the world, my
sure,
friend.
They have.
You exude that, not just in your music sometimes, but who you are, where you go. I've watched. I see it. I was a couple years ago sitting off to the side and watching you sing to the people, and I kept thinking, you're kind of infusing them a little bit, and you're not preaching it. You're just being it.
Yeah.
You seem to be more comfortable being it than preaching it.
Yeah, because I don't know what I'm talking about. You know, it's funny because I have such a tremendous faith in God and love for my Father and Heavenly Father and for Christ who died for me and all that. But I don't have any, I don't have this biblical, overwhelming, big, fat knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
I have friends who can quote Scripture left and right. I know 2 Bible verses.
Do you mind sharing those 2?
Yeah. John 14:2. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you, and if I go and prepare a place, I will come again and receive you unto myself, that where I am, there you may be also. That's like one of the coolest promises in the whole Bible. And the other one was when I was a kid, and my mom led me to Christ as a youngster who had a lot of questions, and
mm-hmm.
and through reading some Scripture to me and trying to and her explaining it to me, mom explaining it to her son,
sure,
instead of preacher pounding on
that's
a
right.
pulpit, you know, or a Sunday school teacher trying to teach a class full of little ones who are out of control,
right?
My mom trying to explain to me her faith. And reading several scriptures to me and using those, but John 3:16, which is a scripture that most anyone who's gone to church
right.
knows that. I mean, I knew John 3:16. I'd heard it my whole little life. Mm-hmm. It was on a cross stitch hanging up in our family room
mm-hmm.
in browns and orange and tans. You know that whole mm-hmm. Thanksgiving mm-hmm. color scheme,
mm.
and it said. You know, John 3:16, for God so loved the world that he gave his own begotten son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish but have everlasting life. My mom didn't read it like that. She said, look right here, it says, for God so loves Johnny that he gave his only son, that if Johnny will trust in him, Johnny will have everlasting life. That whole whosoever and whole world, all that stuff, that's words I didn't understand at
sure.
10 years old. But God loving me that much was the coolest thing ever.
Anybody else ever call you Johnny?
If you hear somebody call me Johnny, you know their family.
There you go.
You know they're either my sister's family's side, mm. the Beckers, mm-hmm. or it's
because you look like about 10 saying that yeah. Johnny word there for a minute.
Yeah.
Do you see the value, though? And I'm going to point it out if you don't, just to challenge you a little bit. We live in a day and age where people mostly hear stuff that they don't understand. We got too much information.
Oh, yeah.
Not enough transformation. Just too much information. And they've heard a lot of empty words across the board from every facet of society, yeah. all over the place. So do you see the value in John Barry saying, I belong on this stage and I'm going to sing from this place, is more powerful, more applicable, more accepted than the stuff they're getting anywhere else? I mean, I don't know if you see that. I see it because I've watched you perform. Do you see that?
You know, I don't know.
Yes, the force is the answer.
Force is very close. So
I understand that. Yeah. I understand that.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's just a rare thing. And maybe it's because you just are more concerned about changing the oil than yeah. other stuff. It just brings that much more to it.
Yeah.
We just live in a day and age, I think, that there's a lot of gaps. And people yeah. are looking for something to fill it. And you remind them of that
yeah.
in your songs.
Well, there are a lot of gaps in a lot of people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of things that are missing, and they don't know what it is. And I think that that's where I think that gap is there because God wants that gap there because He's the only thing He can fill it. And it's that stirring in people's souls that they're missing something. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's intentional. I think it's intentional by our Creator. We're created to have a hole that can only be filled by Him. So,
not bad, preacher. That's pretty good. I can't go any conversation. There's probably a dozen people left in my circle that I can have conversations about John Denver.
Oh, please.
There's Bill Curtis from A&E, a buddy of mine, and
yeah.
I spoke at Windstar in 94. Bill was the host in 93, I think. The regular host was sick, so they called Bill, and he was all jacked up. I actually met Bill in person the first time in 89, and John was in Chicago doing a thing called Higher Ground. And it was around the environment, and he did a couple songs, but he was really mostly speaking. And there was, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 people there, and I was part of the media team, and I called Bill Curtis, who I knew from the news in Chicago. I'd already done the national news and network news and all that stuff, and we ended up sitting next to each other. We've been friends 25 years since. And so he's on there. Richard Kaufman, who is a guest conductor with the Chicago Symphony, who, you know, John Williams calls up for advice kind of guy, right, the composer. He was just in Chicago recently, and Richard would sit in and conduct for JD around the country. So, and then there's you, and there's a few other people. Oprah's one of them where I can go, John Denver, we can have a conversation because it's getting further and further away
yeah.
from those days. However, I'm amazed in the last year, 4 movies I watched all had John's music in it. So
isn't that awesome?
Yeah. People handling his estate are kind of getting it right. When I hear you sing, and I've told you this before, there are very few people with that range that can hit those notes and do those things. And I've often thought, that's where the magic is.
Yeah.
It's that voice thing that he admitted he didn't own. Do you feel like that? You don't own it. You're just kind of taking care of it.
It's on loan, you know. But there, it's funny that there's a timbre in our voices that has a similar. Even though we don't sing like it,
right.
There's something in the timbre of our voices
yeah.
that has a similarity that it's like this common ground yeah. thing. So.
And I think that's what we talked about earlier. His voice yeah. was one that brought people from all backgrounds, all walks of life together. He
yeah.
made no bones about it. He wanted to serve all sides, not one or the other. He was going to do that. The first concert you ever went to was a John Denver concert.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Omni in Atlanta, Georgia, spring of 75, Back Home Again tour.
Mm-hmm. And you did that yeah. for the CMAs.
Yeah.
I got a chance, and I sent that to Annie Denver, and I sent it to Zach Denver.
Did you?
Yeah, I did. And to be able to pull that off, that's not easy. Did you feel kind of had the willies a little bit doing that?
Yeah, because I've played so many of John's songs, and that was not one of them I had done a lot of,
mm-hmm.
if maybe a handful of times.
Mm-hmm.
And so I spent a little time on that one to be sure, because it was that performance on video was a one take.
right.
thing. You know,
right.
I think I did it twice or three times mm-hmm. to get the take we wanted, but it was mm-hmm. you know, top to bottom through without any stops.
Yeah.
And that's unnerving to me.
You know who else was unnerved by that song? I don't know if you ever heard this. Is John Fogerty.
Oh yeah.
He did the song and he's like, I don't know if I want to touch this.
Wow.
It's like looking at the Grand Canyon saying you can't improve on it, so leave it alone.
Yeah.
But he recorded it, and I kind of watch you going through. You guys did it a little bit different, but he said there are just certain songs, and that's yeah. one of them, that are just yeah. like, whoa, what do I do with this?
Yeah, just sing, like, you know, just let it come out like John would let it come out, and just let the story, let John tell the story through you. Mm. You know?
And you've done the same thing with Annie's song.
Oh, I love that song. Oh, I love that song. That song is awesome. It's just one of those pieces of music that's just stirred my soul ever since I heard it.
Mm.
And it's very, very, very cool.
I was listening to that thing I did at Harpo at Oprah Radio for Sirius XM when John passed 10 years ago, and I was listening to that story you tell. And you tell that story in concert a little bit
yeah.
about meeting him backstage and
yeah.
Robin surprising you, and you're not a surprise guy.
Yeah. Yeah, I got to go. She took me to the Fox Theater in Atlanta, Georgia, and we got to meet. You know, it surprised me not only with tickets to the show, but also to go backstage and have a chance to say hello. And
mm-hmm.
and it was surreal. It was really an incredible moment. And of course, Robin says it's a moment she'll never forget because I hardly said two words to him. So,
well, listen, he is one of the most celebrated singer-songwriters, and you have this new thing out called Thomas Road, this new album, and that sounds like a John Denver type singer-songwriter thing. Tell me about that.
Well, Thomas Road's a street I grew up on in Decatur, Georgia, and I say grew up on, even though I only lived there from time of 8 years old through till I turned 13, But I went to started elementary school, started high school, went through elementary school and high school with all the same kids, but that's where my love for music started, and that's where I started to learn. That's where I picked up the guitar. You know, 1972, hello, you know,
they're all there. Carole King, James Taylor, the old drill, yeah,
yeah, John, and you know, just some great, great music. Matter of fact, one of my favorite albums of all time was Carole's Tapestry album.
Mm-hmm.
For years I didn't know there was anything other than AM radio, and my dad bought a stereo that had the little AM dial and FM dial separate speakers on the turntable, you know, and my sister bought Tapestry, and I would lay under the table in the living room, a little youngster, you know, and turn those speakers in and lay between those two speakers and listen to that album backwards and forwards.
True surround sound.
Oh my gosh, it was just amazing to sit and listen to that, and then, you know, John's music, and that's when I started getting an interest in playing guitar, and it all started, you know, and then.
So this album reflects that time for
well,
you.
Well, that song Thomas Road talks about, even though it's a rockin', I mean, and the storyline in the song is more about the fact that, you know, throttled down on the Blue Ridge, I've got lost on, you know, lost on Highway 10 out in the Texas heat, across the line and on the Vegas Strip, you know, all these places, but nothing takes you back home like the street you grew up on. There's nothing like Thomas Road, and because that's where the dreams began, that's where the love began, the street I grew up on, and the people around, and that love of friends and family and neighbors builds confidence in youngsters. And then that love for music and all the different kind of music. My brother was listening to classical music. My sister was listening to Carole King. My mom was listening to gospel. Jeff's dad across the street wouldn't play nothing but Hank Sr. I mean, you know, there was and then us kids, we'd listen to the AM radio, WQXI radio out of Atlanta, and just top 40, you know, everything from the Stylistics to John Denver, so I had a wide variety of music that influenced me, obviously, and so Thomas Road was a great place, and then I wrote a song on the record without intention. I was together with two wonderful songwriters and ended up writing a song inspired by my dad and the kind of man he is. And wrote the song's The Richest Man. And My dad, though he was not financially wealthy whatsoever, he taught me and my brother and my sister that the most valuable things in life typically don't have anything to do with money. And but it's just a story of those two different, you know, the richest mm-hmm. man I ever knew, you know. Well, it starts off as I knew a man who thought he had it all, built a big house with a 10-foot wall. And though his friends were mostly bought, he still thought he had it all. But the richest man I ever knew lived behind a picket fence. Met my mom at 22. They could hardly pay the rent. After dinner at the diner, he'd tip more than he could afford. And on the way back home, I'd sit next to the richest man I ever knew. And as that song kind of goes back and forth with those each verse. And but
well, for a guy who says he's not real good at songwriting, I would have to disagree.
I get in rooms with really good writers and get them lots of coffee.
Yeah, well, that's
good. Keep them going.
So last part of this here, and I've said that four times, by the way, at least four times. From a personal standpoint, to watch the arc of this is just fascinating to me. Been selling stuff out of your trunk and it hits, and you're on country music television and people know who you are, and next thing you're going to fanfare and they do this, and then it kind of drops off. Everything has a shelf life, especially this kind of business.
Oh, yeah. Short
and then,
shelf life.
Absolutely. And then you're still pounding away at it, pounding away at it, pounding away at it. And then things start happening again. Little bits and pieces here, kind of like in the movie E.T. when he's leaving those Reese pieces, you know, and he kind of going after him. And you kind of just keep following all that stuff.
Yeah.
In all of that time, as you followed this path, do you ever question the calling at all?
There's a few times I'd rather be a fisherman at the beach.
Right.
You know. And there's been a few times I've gotten tired. Mm-hmm. You know. And but.
So when that happens, does something come along and keep you moving, or do you just kind of find it? How's that work for you?
Well, I'm sure you've probably hit a golf ball or two in your life.
I have.
And this is much like golf.
Really?
You knock golf balls around and you just throw clubs and you hate it and you're never going to play again. And then you swing the club and all of a sudden there's this beautiful shot.
Yeah.
Or you sing a song and it's just like, oh my gosh.
Mm.
And you're hooked for another 5 years.
Yeah, that's right.
So.
That's a great analogy.
Yeah.
You see all this. You're 60 almost. You've been at this a long time. What's the rest of the story look like for you, if you could predict it down the road?
Well,
what do you want to do that you haven't done yet, besides write a book?
I would like to have the trifecta. I would like for people who genuinely love the music that I'm a part of the format to go, oh, yeah, I see that face. That's John Barry, and he has a song called... Even if it's just one. Even if it's Old Holy Night.
Mm.
Maybe if it's a new song.
Mm.
If it's Thomas Road or Richest Man. Not they don't have to name off 12 songs.
Just one.
If they could just put that name and that face and a song together, make that little trifecta come together for a moment. You know, we had a couple of moments in 94 when Your Love Amazes Me hit. And because of the brain surgery, there was a lot of press around it, but I never had the opportunity personally to go out and support my record. And then we had some more hits and all that, and then She's Taking a Shine and You and Only You and that kind of stuff, and then I had to have vocal cord surgery, and then I had to take almost a year off. And a year in the music business is a lifetime. And so... We had those moments where things were not so much, and not so much. Sit down. So if I had that moment to be able to do that, where we had the little trifecta come together, that would be a nice. That'd be fun. Be fun to do.
So that's what it sounded like on the bus on a cold winter night in Chicago, and. Just about to finish off the editing here in the vaunted Life 2.0 studios, and I thought to myself, Self, you started out the show with an amazing song called Thomas Road, and then in the middle of the show, you put in Beautifully Broken, which is incredible.
got to put one more in. And after listening to some of the tracks, I realized that my favorite song from the Thomas Rhodes CD, which, by the way, is available at johnberry.com, is a song called Why Didn't I? It's written by Michael Boggs and Barry Weeks, and this just might be the song that gives JB his trifecta. Thanks for listening. Safe travels. Until next time, adios.
Chances I could have taken, words I could have said, why didn't I? Prayers I should have prayed, things I could have changed, why didn't I? Every moment's here for a moment, then it's gone. Let it take.